Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In English, okay? So, thank you. And I have the pleasure to be here today with the first guest of honor, Claude Lalumière from Canada. And I would like to start with the way we met. It was a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, actually.
In 2016, in Barcelona.
Yes, in Barcelona. We were at one of the best Eurocon that we've ever went to, and he approached me in a weird way, like, I want to come to Italy. I definitely want to be translated in Italian, and I have a very big fascination for the Mediterranean Sea, right? So not just Italy, but all the countries that have to do with the Mediterranean Sea. And so I was like, oh, okay, let's see. I didn't know him. I didn't know much of the work that Claude wrote in the past. So we started to exchange some emails trying to find the right stories. And it wasn't easy because of me, because it's my fault, because I on the project that I run as a publisher, I publish a particular kind of science fiction, and Claude is doing really everything. So it was my fault to find the right stories, but finally we made it, and we made a small booklet here in dual language, and I'm very happy to have the chance to invite him here, and to hopefully introduce his work, amazing work that has really many influences, as Claude is both a reader, and he was a bookseller, and is interested in comics, interested in movies, all that has to do with imagination and the fantastic. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So. Well, so I've prepared some questions, first of all, let's say I would like to start with, because the people here they don't know much of your work, so I would like to just introduce yourself.
Okay. So my name is Claude Lalumière. I'm from Montreal originally. And for many years, I was a bookseller from the age of 23 to about 33, I guess, I was a bookseller. I owned two bookstores in Montreal. And but in the back of my mind was always the notion that I would want to be a writer one day. And the more that my business grew, the more that I realized I would never have the time to be a writer. So I decided to sell my business, and I began to write. At first, I wrote a lot of reviews and criticism to get my name out there more. And then, as of 2002, I started to publish fiction. And I've since published more than 100 stories. I've been translated into 7 languages, adapted in several media, and I have 5 books out. And as Francesco said, I have a deep connection to the Mediterranean, and so I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, so I would like to start analyze these feelings you have. So in an interview, you said that the utopian impulse was always very strong in me, in you, you say.
Right.
Even when I was very young. It's very hard for me to accept the world as it is. Is this the main drive that that push you to write, or is it something else, the main drive?
No, I would say that that is probably the main drive. I think a big part of the artistic impulse, whether it be with writing or painting or anything, is that we feel that in some way the world is being wrongly narrated or wrongly represented, that there is something wrong about how as a society we interact with the world or interact with each other or with history or at almost every level. And part of the artistic impulse, I think, is to course correct, is to say, no, there's another way to perceive, there's another way to think. There's another way to dream, and I think that really is at the base of why I write.
So you're saying that the real facts are wrong, and the fiction can be more true than the truth itself.
I do like to say that, for example, essay writing is the art of lying with facts, and fiction is the art of telling the truth with lies.
Right. It. At the bottom of many of your stories, there are myths. Maybe that's another reason why you're attracted by the Mediterranean,
that's
where a lot of myth and legend come from, at least the Western society.
And those have always spoken to me quite a lot.
Yeah, of course, those are the roots of storytelling in a way, right? But of course, there are a difference between the ancient myth and the modern myth. You know, myth.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And so, in a way, now that everything has been said and everything, you know, we're also beyond postmodernism. We don't know where we are. You know, is it better to retelling, to telling again and again with different words, with different shapes, the same myth, or is it better to try to create new myth?
Well, actually, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said, and I'm going to have to go back a little bit and address some of the components of your question, because I don't necessarily agree with where you're coming from. This is a common thing that we hear, the notion that it's all been said, that it's all been done, that every story's been told, that there's only so many types of stories, that everything is simply a rehash of something else that someone else has thought of. Where I agree that all art is in dialogue with both previous art and with culture in general, and without that dialogue, it's hard to have any meaning. I disagree that it's all been said. Mm-hmm. I think that is not true. And I remember once, I don't know, I think about 5 years ago, I was on a panel in French, and the context of the panel was, is it still possible to write fresh stories about the well-known monsters, such as vampires and zombies and all of that? And the entire panel was, no, it's not possible. And then it came to me, and I said, well, I don't believe that. I think that it's all in execution, and it's all in perspective. And then a few months later, the moderator of that panel, who was the strongest guy in his belief that it was impossible to do that, read the French translation of my first collection. And then he wrote a public blog post, and he sent me a link apologizing for disbelieving me that you could not write fresh stories about that, because, for example, there's the ethical treatment of meat, which you included in there, which is one of my most popular stories, partly because it's a zombie story pretty much like no other zombie story. So I do not believe that thing. And I do think that part of art, part of the artistic impulse, is to say what has not been said, we are driven by this impulse that there's something that hasn't been said, or hasn't been said correctly at least. And we might never be able to articulate it. Just like utopia is a thing that we can never achieve, it is only a thing we can strive toward. It's the same thing that truth is probably not something we can ever actually express, but it is something that we are striving toward. And that quest is, in that quest, there is an infinity of expression that is possible. So back to your question about myth, I think the ideal thing is to remain in conversation so that you do refer in some way, directly or indirectly, to myth, culture, or art that already exists, but you add something. For example, I had this project that ran for a couple of years called Lost Myths. Mm-hmm. And what it was literary myths that sounded like they were from ancient cultures, but were entirely made up. And a handful of them sometimes riffed off of existing stuff, but most of them were entirely fictional. But they were written in the style of a myth, not in the style of a modern story, but in the style of how a myth is composed. And I would perform these stories. I would have, I had a slideshow, and I had a soundtrack, and I would perform these short myths to audiences. And often after the shows, some people from the audience would come to me and say, what country is that myth from? I've never heard of that before. Because I used the form and I used the structure that we're used to from myth, but I grafted on it something entirely new, which gave it but it had that ring of authenticity.
But anyway, the myths are, by definition, probably not real. Well, you know,
yes,
they're
right,
made up.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to another big theme in your fiction is a theme of identity. Of the other, the big other, right? Yeah. I think that science fiction is the perfect ground for developing new and bizarre identity architectures. So the next question is, what are the strangest or most unusual characters you've created? Apart from the one that it's
apart
there.
From the zombies yeah. in there. Yes. Well, I would I'm going to discount all of the characters from the Lost Myths, because I wrote dozens and dozens of those, and they were mainly based on creating these very peculiar, strange beasts. So I'm gonna gloss over those. I think the character that kind of comes to mind really quickly is one in one of the stories that I sent you, and it's a Roman predator. He's a character in a kind of post-apocalyptic world where not much is explained. We know there was some sort of genetic war that wiped out most life on Earth, and there are people who live in this walled enclave on the island of Montreal, and we come to understand that there's an elite group among the Montrealers who survive, who are given some sort of shape-shifting potion that is clearly based on some sort on the gene wars that happened, and they basically become werewolves once a month and go hunt for food for people in the enclave, and then the werewolf, he's the leader of the pack, merges with an alien who has crash landed on Earth, and because his biology is already altered, he's used to merging with something else, and this bizarre alien lands and is like clearly wounded, and something happens, and then they merge into one creature, and then the metamorphosis just keeps expanding exponentially, and the character becomes stranger and stranger and stranger. Wow. So I would say that's probably
this is very weird.
One of my weirdest characters. Yes.
Okay. Then I would like to ask you something about Canada, but you know, not
right.
The geography.
Right.
Let's say Canada is a dual language country. Mm-hmm. So. How does that impact the writers and readers? Do you feel the southern pressure of the U.S. market, or do you prefer to have two vocabularies, two cultures to build your words?
Okay, well, again, there's a lot in that question.
So
I'm going to start with Canada, okay. Because quite likely you only have here a very vague idea of what Canada is like.
We have Robert Sawyer.
Right, yeah. And you all know Justin Trudeau.
And Margaret Atwood.
Yeah. And even though I live and write in English, I was actually born a Francophone. I went to school in French. My family are unilingual Francophones. I grew up in a Francophone part of Montreal, even though the city of Montreal is very multicultural and multilingual, but I grew up entirely in French. And yet somehow I turned out to be an English writer. But and that is very typically Canadian, you know, to have that kind of weird linguistic dichotomy. I would say, though, that the readerships are very distinct. There's very little overlap between the French readers and the English readers. And that's partly because most people in English Canada do not read in French, mm-hmm. and most Francophone authors are not translated into English.
In Canada, itself.
In Canada.
Wow.
Okay, so that... French Canadian culture is actually not very well known by English Canada at all, and the English culture that French Canadians consume is American.
Yeah.
It's not; they barely consume English Canadian culture. So there's very little interaction between the two cultures. I wish there were more. And there are signs that it's starting to change a little bit, but there's an expression in Canada, the two solitudes. And it refers to the two cultures who are so estranged from each other.
But then who's the biggest Francophone author in Canada?
Oh, my God. Yeah,
this is a difficult question even for you.
Well, there is. I am thinking of one author in particular whose name, of course, escapes me. He writes Stephen King-like stuff, and stuff has been made into movies, so he's actually Patrick Sénécal. That's right, Patrick Sénécal. I just had it. Yeah, and he is kind of Quebec's Stephen King. So he's pretty big. Yeah.
But so basically, you're all trying to write in English.
He only writes in French.
No, okay, but I'm saying, for example, I've translated another Canadian author, right. Jean-Louis Trudel,
yeah, yes.
Which looks like French. I mean, but well, Francophone, but he writes.
Jean-Louis. Okay, Jean-Louis mostly writes in French. He writes a little bit in English, but I would say his output is about 90%. French and 10% English. Now, Jean-Louis, just to explain more about Canada again. Most Francophones are in the province of Quebec, and most of the rest of the country is Anglophone. But there are French communities throughout the country, and Jean-Louis is a Franco-Ontarian. So he's a Francophone who grew up in an English environment. So that's a little different. And to make it a little weirder, he's not actually of French Canadian descent. His parents are Europeans who happened to emigrate to Canada. So he's actually a first generation Canadian. So he's kind of a special case. Even his French doesn't sound French Canadian. His French sounds very much like European's French.
Staying into the language, do you think that, a language is so important in relation to the plot, to the other things, or what's the importance of a language? If you have to, you know, you're choosing a language because of the market?
No, I actually do not ever think of the market. Mm-hmm. The reason I write in English has nothing to do with the market. It has everything to do with my inner life. My inner life is entirely in English. I dream in English. I think in English. It is easier for me to express myself in English than it is in French. In fact, I'm translated into French more than into any other language, but I don't do my own translations. And in fact, once, for one of my stories, the editor thought that I would do a better job because it was a hard one to translate, and he hated the translation so much that he had it redone by somebody else, because my French is not considered up to snuff because I'm... My French is very Quebecois. It is not an international French, and even in Quebec, we in the publishing industry, they strive toward a more international type of French, and that French does not come very easily to me.
But you were growing up in a Francophone family.
Yes.
So probably.
But in a working class Montreal area where my French is not something okay. When I go to France, everybody thinks I'm an Anglophone. They think I'm an Anglophone who speaks particularly good French, because they listen to my accent in French and they cannot believe that it is a Francophone's accent. Because
I think that applies to a lot of people.
No. The other people, they know that they're Francophones. They'll just pretend not to understand them. Me, they don't pretend to not understand me because they think I'm an Anglophone. They think, wow, he's doing so well for an Anglophone. But it is because we have a very peculiar accent where I come from. We contract the language much more. We just speak a little differently. And that is my natural French expression. Okay. And that's not one that is acceptable.
Yeah, I was hoping that, well, not hoping, but I was thinking that maybe the reason was that you found in your youth probably everything in English for science fiction.
That was definitely, yeah. Well, I actually, okay. Well, the reason I speak English is that I learned English all by myself by the time I was 3 years old. Partly because what my parents tell me is that I always switch the TV to the English channels. And at that age, you're just a sponge. So I just, you know, and English became my inner language because all the things I loved the most were in English. So yes, that's a large, and I think also it became, because my family, everyone spoke French, in my neighborhood, everybody spoke French, English was kind of my private language. So it became the world, the language of my inner world. It was the language that only I had. So I think that really contributed to it, to English becoming how I dream, you know, yeah.
There's another Canadian that I forgot to mention, that is William Gibson.
Yes.
And you told me a very nice anecdote about him. I would like you to share that with
sure,
the people.
Oh, sure, of course. Okay, so back when I was a bookseller, I think this must have been in 1991. I think Virtual Light is fourth book, it just come out. And Gibson had decided that he would not do any appearances in big chain stores. He would only do appearances in small independent bookstores. And at the time, he was like the hottest author on the planet. Everybody wanted a piece of William Gibson. So I get a phone call from Bantam Books, who are part of the same company as Mondadori. So, you know, it's the big publisher. And they say, we have William Gibson. And he wants to appear in independent bookstores, so we're offering him to you. So, of course, I said yes. And at the time, you know, my store had been open for 2 years. I was like, you know, I was a young man. I was 25. I was struggling. I mean, I was going along, but it was a bit, you know, it was a struggle. And then William Gibson lands in my store. Well, in the weeks leading to William Gibson's appearance, every newspaper, every TV station, every radio station all wanted to speak to me because it was where William Gibson was going to appear. And suddenly, my store was in all the media, free advertising. And after Gibson's appearance, of which we had hundreds of people that were lining up down the street in the rain around the block, it was immense. After that, my business tripled and stayed at that level from there on in and kept growing. And if not for William Gibson, my store would probably have never been as successful as it turned out to be.
And then William Gibson never showed up again.
Well, I sold the store a few years after that anyway. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if there are any questions. We have around 15 minutes, but otherwise we go ahead with other questions. No? Okay. Then I would like to ask you about your connection with our land, with our Mediterranean Sea.
Absolutely. I only started to travel late in life, at the age of 40, 12 years ago. And the first thing I did was I took a 33-day trip through the big cities of Europe. And the biggest thing that hit me was I took the train from Rome to Bari because I was going to take a boat to Greece. And as soon as I got off the train in Bari, the smell of the Adriatic hit me. like really powerfully. So I walked toward the shore, took off my shoes, went, you know, just waded in the sea and just took in the sight of the Adriatic, which is gorgeous, and wrote a story in my head, a nearly 4,000 word long story. I composed it all in my head right there. But of course, I had no way to write anything. That night in my cabin on the boat, I wrote the entire thing in one draft. And it was a story set in Barrie called The Sea at Barrie. And then on the same trip, same thing happened again. I was in Nice and I was watching the sunset, and a whole other story came into my head. Of course, that time I was three blocks away from my hotel, so I just rushed to my hotel, and again I wrote it down in one sitting. And I think that all comes back to my fondest childhood memory. On my mother's side, my family is from the Gaspé. What the Gaspé is, it is the portion of Quebec that is on the peninsula of Quebec, and it juts out into the Atlantic Ocean. It's at the very tip. And my grandparents lived exactly at the very tip of the peninsula. And across the road from their house, there was a hidden beach that no one knows is there, that I visited 20 years later, and it was pristine, because no one ever goes there, because you have to know, and almost no one goes there. So, and we spent our afternoons there, building fires and waiting in the ocean. And I was from the big city, I was from Montreal, and I had never seen or experienced anything like the ocean. And here was the Atlantic. And I just felt my mind totally expand. I was just a little kid. I must have been 4 years old or something. And it just was the most profound experience, the happiest experience I'd ever had. And since then, the sea, and the Atlantic especially, has a huge influence on me, and the Mediterranean just is a continuation of that. And every time I come to the Mediterranean, I feel I get inspired for new fiction. I feel my heart expand. I feel my imagination expand. I feel a great serenity just descend on me. So
is it the nature or The sea could be, you know, similar, even though probably the smell not, but it's also what's around the sea.
I love the food in the Mediterranean. I love the people. I feel very much more at home here. For example, as a Montrealer, the thing with Montreal is that it is an oddity in North America. It's a European city in North America, and I don't feel at home in the rest of North America. Even in the rest of Canada, I feel like people, like here in Montreal, we're concerned about good food and good drink and beauty and the good life. And we're, you know, like we're, there's a neighborhood in Montreal that has the most artists per postal code than anywhere else in the world, because it's that kind of place. So when I come here, I feel at home again. I feel, oh yeah, this is what I know. This is and like a lot of Europe, in Montreal we have layers of history. We're not as old as Europe, but we're older than most of North America. And it is a city rich with myth and rich with history. So here that aspect does resonate with me as well. Yeah.
So what are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a lot right now. I'm not a focused writer. I'm always all over the place. And I always have several projects on the go. And then at one point, one project gains more momentum and I focus on that one. At the moment, I would say that my most active project is something called The Chronicles of the Second Global War. And it's an alternate history in which all of the cities that we know, or pretty much as we know them, but the geopolitical map is entirely different. For example, and there was a big first global war that happened between 1881 and 1911, and that changed the map as we know it. And after a century of peace, a second global war erupts in modern times now. And so things are changing again. And what might be of interest to hear is that one of the big countries in this world is something called the Mediterranean Communities. And it is basically an Italian empire that goes from east of France, and then most of it, all of the islands that are in the sea, Greece, parts of Turkey, and a little bit more, and it's but the capital is Firenze, though. It's not Roma.
And, I'm not offended.
And partly because part of they achieved their dominance at one point farther back in history because they the science of Da Vinci was actually acted upon much more. So they became kind of a superpower in terms of technology.
Oh, good. I thought it was Renzi taking over the world.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Our former prime minister. Yeah. So, well, we have some 10 minutes left, but again, please don't feel shy because this is like a time for question, for asking anything. Please.
No, I know, that's what I hear. Well, I mean, that's probably where my ancestors are from. Most Quebecois come from Brittany. No, in France, I've only been to Paris and to Nice. So I have to explore more eventually.
So the Northern Coast, yes. Because the Northern Coast is much more rugged.
Right, right.
The Southern Coast is nice.
Yeah. Maybe, I'm not sure. Okay. Yeah. Okay, well.
Claude is taking suggestions because he wants to come back very often.
Oh, yeah.
If you have any place, suggest.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm already working on his next visit.
Okay, yeah, please. Please do. That'd be great. Oh, okay. Oh, you see? Okay, well, I will tell you, as a Francophone, I find the French very difficult, but I love the Belgians. I love Belgian.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then I want to ask you also about your deep interest for other media in science fiction and fantastic, like the comics, for example, and the movies and all these other, you know, ways of.
Right. Well, I mean, as a creator, I'm a little less interested in those. Though I started off in my youth, I started off as a filmmaker. I made two films back when I was in my early 20s, but the hoops you had to jump through proved to be just too annoying, my creative process is too internal for that kind of product. And but I love cinema, and I'm especially fond of the visionary kind of director like David Lynch or Wes Anderson and in comics, well, that's my first love. That is what, as a child, that's what I consumed most of all. I read comics, I can't even count how many comics I've read. So I've always retained a huge interest in comics.
And I've seen you posting very often, like top five or top ten of these.
Well,
okay,
give me
your list.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's also a way to get people to interact, because people love to interact with lists, and it's an easy thing. It's a fun thing to do. So yeah.
Well, okay, let's start with the comics.
Okay.
Give me the top five or top three, whatever you think.
Okay. Well, probably Jack Kirby is always top of anything. I'm a huge fan of Jack Kirby's work. Then I would say probably Love and Rockets is very high there. Most crime comics by Ed Brubaker. That's a little far from what we're doing, but I really love his work. There was a strange thing that's probably not very well known here called Yummy Fur, back in the 1980s and 90s by a Canadian cartoonist called Chester Brown, and in the pages of Yummy Fur, he did this extremely bizarre story called Ed the Happy Clown, and he was not a happy clown, and as a title like that would have to be, and it was one of the strangest, most visceral, most unforgettable experiences that I've ever had just reading anything. Unfortunately, he didn't bring it to a satisfying conclusion, but up until the conclusion, it was magnificent, and certainly one of the best things. And one of my big heroes as well is another Canadian, a Montrealer actually, called Bernie Miro, and he does this comic book called The Jam, and it's all about utopianism. So that really speaks to me. What The Jam is this totally normal guy who decides to put on a modified gym suit to make it look a little bit like a superhero costume, and he has these imaginary adventures on rooftops with his dog. But occasionally, he runs into people, and he just helps them. And there is a slightly fantastic element in that, because his optimism is boundless and seems unshakable, the devil is after him and keeps trying to put these obstacles in his path to break him, to make him lose his sense of optimism, and the devil always fails.
Okay, then let's finish with the books. You've been a critic and columnist.
Yeah,
so
I have.
Let's give me the top three or five.
Well, that's much easier.
Yeah.
Okay, well, my favorite writer is J.G. Ballard. So okay. Crash is my favorite novel, and my favorite collection is the complete short stories of J.G. Ballard. So that's you can't get any better than that as far as I'm concerned. Because my main interest is short fiction, I would list Beyond the Safe Zone by Robert Silverberg as maybe, in terms of, if you want to learn how to write the quintessential science fiction story, and you want to learn structure, how to merge idea and character and setting and make them all resonate with each other and write it in a science fiction way, there's no better book than that one. I would also list Stranger Things Happen by Kelly Link. All the stories of R.A. Lafferty and Ray Vukcevich also, like all of his short stories.
Okay. If there are no questions from the audience. Oh, yes, there is one. Rich.
Sure. Okay, well, I've already talked a little bit about a story called The Ethical Treatment of Meat, which is, which the word zombie does not appear in the story ever.
That's why I publish it.
Yeah, but it is a zombie story, and it is, it's a story in which, in which zombies have become the dominant, the dominant species, but after their initial feeding frenzy died down, they just became suburban, just like everybody else, and they farm humans as farm animals. But then the gist of the story is that because zombies can't have children, they suddenly have, because they're vestigially human, and some of them begin to have this desire for children. So they begin to adopt human pets as children. Of course, it all goes wrong. And I say, the story is called The Ethical Treatment of Meat. So that tells you how badly that goes. There's another story there called This is the Ice Age, which is my most popular story. It's been translated, I think, now in 5 or 6 languages. It's been reprinted, I don't know how many times. It's been adapted for stage. It's just had a lot of traction. And this one is one of my many stories set in Montreal. And it's again a post-apocalyptic one. I love to destroy Montreal, so in your stories, destroy what you love. The world has changed. It's been taken over by something I call quantum ice, and everything electrical has erupted in this bizarre fractaling ice. And of course, nothing works anymore. And because we carry phones and we're near technology all the time, tons of people died when this happened. Planes crashed, automobiles went out of control, and also spiraled. So there's a lot of survivors, but there's nothing that works. And it's the story of two teenagers trying to survive in this landscape where the world has completely changed. The title story, where the title comes from, is called Maxim Fujiyama and Other Persons. And it is, again, a post-apocalyptic thing. We don't know what the apocalypse was. All that we know is that almost everybody was wiped out. And he was ill during that, and he wakes up after a long illness, and everybody's gone, or almost everybody, and he just wanders the city of Vancouver, which is where that story is set, and there's some other survivors, and there's some adventures, and eventually he befriends a family of dogs, and he kind of becomes part of their pack, but then he encounters others,
don't spoil it.
And I won't spoil it, but so that story is very much about who is a person, who is not a person, what personhood is, and in fact, every story in that book does deal with that.
It's identity.
And a lot of my stories deal with the idea of personhood. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Claude.
Thank you, Francesco.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificast.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Allarme rosso, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 è pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 posizionato.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.